and Leopard's Leaf, I believe, are the wine sponsors. Enjoy yourselves.
Thank you very much, Sandy. I must say, I really enjoyed reading your book. I read a lot of non-fiction history, as it happens, and sometimes it can be kind of hard going, but this really is an easy read, this history of the South African National Gallery. I think one of the reasons is because, as a Cape Townian interested in art, and being in some way part of the sort of art scene for the last 2 decades or so, the National Gallery always features quite large in one's consciousness, and that's where I want to start talking to you about. In recent years, in recent months, we've seen incredible activity at the National Gallery, and as your sort of long view history of this institution shows, it's not unusual for the National Gallery to host controversy, protest, outspoken kind of vitriol, etc. But, you know, in recent months we've seen a march on the National Gallery by SWET, the sex workers advocacy group, in protest of the way that a particular exhibition, Our Lady, had been curated, and an artist who had been put onto that exhibition had been curated onto the exhibition. A work has been vandalized, as you mentioned at the end of this book, by Dean Hutton, and of course everybody who's reading the newspapers or looking on social media knows that that's had a kind of afterlife very recently, with that the work, Fuck White People, being declared as not being hate speech. But the work itself was vandalized. People took it upon themselves to go into the National Gallery and to deliberately destroy or deface the work. And, you know, if one looks further back, there have been many, many heated debates, discussions, arguments, and even, you know, damaging and defacement of work in the past. Why is this particular institution, why is this particular art museum a focus of so much public and popular interest, even from people who don't normally perhaps enter the gallery? There are other museums in South Africa, there are other museums with collections which are comparable to the National Gallery. I think the Johannesburg Art Gallery's collection is certainly comparable, if not, you know, better than the holdings of the National Gallery. But people don't seem to get so vent up about it. What is it about this institution?
Is this working?
Yes.
Well, I've given us the subtitle to this book, Reflections on Art and National Identity, because what struck me as being the two really interesting things that might form a sort of leitmotif through the history, which inevitably can't be a history about absolutely everything when an institution's been going for nearly 150 years. What seemed interesting was the question of what it means to be a National Gallery specifically, and secondly, how a public art collection negotiates the question of what its collections should be. In other words, where does the art in an art gallery or an art collection begin and end? What belongs in an art collection, what belongs elsewhere? So to take the first of those two points, the idea of a National Gallery, and I think, you know, the answer to your question of why people feel so enormously involved in this gallery is because of that, because it is called officially the National Gallery of the country. And what goes along with that, and it seems to be an increasing tendency, is a sense that in some way we all have a stake in it, we all have some kind of ownership of this, it belongs to the nation. And indeed it does, it's state funded. And has been since the end of the 19th century. But what I try and point out in my introduction is something that I'm trying to sort of deal with, something that I see a lot in the literature, and I hear it a lot from people in the teaching situation, is the idea that a National Gallery's collection should reflect the nation. And I try to just historically take issue with that, because in fact, if you look at the earliest of the big national collections in Europe and much later in the States. One of the striking things about them was that their collections, in fact, generally did not reflect the nation's art, or only very minimally. Just to take the Louvre Museum, which was the first great prototype art collection as an example, opened in the late 18th century, and massively stocked with the art of countries other than France, even though it's in Paris. It was opened specifically in order to be for the people, so in that sense, of course, it belonged to the people. But that didn't mean, as far as the curators of the Louvre were concerned, that the collection itself should reflect the nation's art. On the contrary, what it reflected was an international culture. So, and I think that this needs to be kind of just, we need to remind ourselves of this as a historical fact about the beginning of these kinds of collections, because so much is said nowadays in criticism of this gallery, because its collection is so much made up of art from other places, and of course the target place is Europe. And for that reason it's branded as being a colonial gallery. Now, I don't particularly take a stand on this, but it may well be that it's time to completely change this.
We'll get to the colonial gallery later.
Yeah, but that, I think it just needs to be put in historical perspective that in fact the big national collection in the capital city of a country has typically tried to be the custodian of an international culture. And of course, that requires that you have an idea of a canonical tradition. You have an idea that there are certain artists, in the case of art museums, that are worth collecting, no matter where they come from. And it doesn't matter that you in Australia or in Germany have a collection of Italian art, if you believe that that Italian art is better than anybody else's art. And what's happened, interestingly, I think, in just very recent years, is that consensus about the canon has fallen away. Mm. And at the same time, in South Africa, we're also getting this tremendous and healthy swelling up of a national search for national identity. Mm. And so those two things, I think, are coming together.
I mean, one of the things that you point out in the book is that search for national identity was certainly there, but in a very kind of perverse way, I suppose, from the 30s,
yes,
with,
exactly.
We'll get maybe into that, but the appointment of certain directors,
yes,
who pushed one line or whatever. I suppose that brings us to the question of the directors. One of the things I learned, I kind of always assumed the National Gallery had a director, but I learned that from your book that a permanent director was only instituted in the late 40s, I think. There were honorary directors before that. And even before that, there were just sort of committees that put exhibitions together. But I think for many people, the role of a director of a national gallery, a major museum, is very important. And I think you do illustrate in your book that the interests and the ambitions of particular people, whether they were honorary directors, not official directors, there was, for a long time, a very close association with the Michaelis School of Fine Arts, so that whoever was the director of the Michaelis would almost become the director of the National Gallery. These directors have had a major impact on collection policy, acquisitions policy, exhibition policy, etc. Would you talk a little bit about that and the role that directors have played over the years? Am I over-exaggerating this importance of directors? Because, I mean, I know that the curatorial staff are very important, particularly in recent years, as there's been a healthier kind of population of curatorial staff. But it seems like these directors are incredibly powerful in terms of, steering the ship.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is true that in the early days, there was pretty much only the director there and nobody else. He tended to have a secretary and a couple of technical assistants, but there weren't any other curators. And it's only really in the 1960s that the gallery has enough money to afford a decent, respectable curatorial staff. It grows enormously suddenly in the 60s because its budget suddenly grows enormously. So before then, the director is enormously important because he's pretty much the only person there who's doing the creative work. And I did focus quite a lot on the different directors. because it seemed to me that either serendipitously or by design, they did bring different visions to the gallery. And just to take an example, I mean, the first one who was the professional full-time director took up office in 1949, and his name was John Paris. He was brought out from Liverpool in the UK. And he was already a museum professional. As Andrew says, people who'd been in charge before were the art school directors. So they were practicing artists. They had a completely different kind of perspective on the job. Once John Paris came, and very soon after, an assistant director was then appointed too, and a very good scholar called von Moltke from Germany, those two had a very, you might say, old-style curatorial approach to the gallery. What they wanted to see was the gallery being the kind of gallery that I described before, a collection of the greatest works that it could possibly manage to afford. And it coincided with a small window, a post-war period, just in the 50s, when a great number of loans were made to the institution from private collectors, the Beit family, for example, the Robinson family, from Count Labia's family, somebody called Lysett Green, who had built up a very interesting collection in the UK and then found himself in South Africa. And so suddenly, just in that period in the 1950s, the gallery found itself as the recipient of works by Velasquez, by Rembrandt, by Hals, by Vermeer. I mean, an astonishing array of top quality old master works. And it could then play part of being a traditional national gallery of old master art, with the emphasis on history. But John Paris was very unpopular for all sorts of interesting reasons and was got rid of. They asked him to leave before he actually had to be forced out. And so he left in the early 60s. He was replaced by a man called Bockhorst, who'd come from the Michaelis collection. He was a Dutch man by birth. He had completely different interests. And I think with a good deal of government nudging too, he was asked to put a big focus on collecting national art instead. And so suddenly in the 60s, and with a lot of money coming from the government all of a sudden, you find the gallery suddenly switching to doing lots and lots of purchasing of contemporary South African art. So there, and this sort of
and they were comparatively well-heeled at that time in terms of the acquisition budget.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Suddenly, and it wasn't just the gallery, they gave a lot of money to the museum and to the library as well. I can only imagine it was partly that South Africa was very prosperous at that time, and there'd just been a government inquiry which had found that all of these institutions were very poorly funded. So suddenly they lavished money on it, but it was spent on South African contemporary art. So that was a moment when suddenly the gallery did reflect the nation, and it needs to be said, at that time in the 60s, they started for the first time buying art by black painters and sculptors. And the first one was in 1964, as late as that. Mm. But I think there's a reason.
I'm going to get back to that. But yeah, I mean, one of the things that I found very interesting, just coming from your points now, was I didn't realize how much the National Gallery featured in the international press. You quote from, you know, articles in the Burlington magazine and things like that, where people were actually talking about the South African National Gallery and its exhibitions and its collections in what I guess one could call the international media, I suppose, the European-focused media, because of these incredible loan collections, which
yes.
really were really important. I suppose, yeah, I pointed out that the directors were important, but I suppose there were political forces behind them. I mean, you indicate that people can read this for themselves, that Paris was kind of shoved out, and Bockhorst, who seems to be much more conservative and in line with the kind of National Party ideology, gets put in place and then given a lot more money and freedom to do things. So, you know, Anna, the amount of detail and historical research is incredible. I mean, you've trawled the archives, you read through, you know, these minutes, and, you know, the history is 150 years of history of this gallery and its various iterations. I suppose my question is, why why should we be interested in the history of a gallery, an art gallery, in 1940, in 1930, in 1870, when we have such pressing issues facing us today in terms of the way that art is represented, the way that acquisitions are made? What is the raison d'etre for this book, I guess?
Well, I'm one of those weird people who just finds history very interesting. I mean, I don't know how...
And you make it very interesting as well.
I don't know how you can live your life without knowing how something was in the past. I mean, it complexifies things in such an important way. It introduces subtleties into your way of thinking about something. It introduces doubts into your received opinions. So much is sort of known in a superficial kind of way about this gallery, and there are so many sort of fixed opinions about it. But it's often based on not very much hard information. So I suppose my feeling is that you need to get a sense of the longer view of something in order to make sure you're accurate and make sure... for one thing, it's often suggested that it was a kind of invention of the 1990s for what's often called traditional African artefacts to be seriously invested in at the gallery. But in fact, one of the things that John Paris did in the 1950s was to try to create a department of what he called prehistoric and indigenous art. He tried very hard to get that started, and he featured in exhibitions. He got work brought over from the other museums and showed them in the gallery. This was very new at the time, but it was an initiative that we find again very strongly in the 80s and 90s, and we suppose that it's the first time.
I mean, I must say, I do find echoes of the recent history continuing in the past, if that makes sense. And that did come as a surprise to me. I mean, I thought I knew quite a bit about the National Gallery, and I was very interested in to see that so many debates that have cropped up in the last 10 years have actually been thrashed out since the 1890s, I guess, in one way or another. One of the things I think we have to face a reality here. The National Gallery, as you point out, is got this name, the National Gallery. Therefore, there's a kind of ownership, and it's seen as being very important. But we are in a situation where, in a couple of months, enormous new institution is going to be opening up, Zeitz-Mokka at the waterfront, and we look with anticipation to see what's going to be there and what it's represented. But the promise is that this is going to be a major museum of African art. It's going to be the most important museum of African art in the world, apparently, with enormous bequests, enormous purchasing budget, which you talk about in your book. In addition, there are so many private museums opening up and private initiatives. I can think of, there's one just down the road that's being built at the moment. There's the new church. There are various other endeavors for private museums of contemporary art to be built. So my question is, does the National Gallery really fulfill the same function that it used to in the time when there wasn't these kind of private museums? I suppose private donors used to give to the National Gallery very generously, but obviously the fashion now is to build a museum in one's own name. Is there a need for the National Gallery? Should the National Gallery perhaps stop collecting contemporary art, for example, which, as you point out, since I think the 1870s has been always been focused on the contemporary, almost resistant to these old masters coming in. My question is, does the National Gallery really have a function from a historical perspective in terms of what's happening at the moment?
Function from a historical perspective?
It might be an unfair question, but you do at the end of your book make suggestions about the future of the National Gallery and what might be done. And I think this is a real challenge to a national institution.
It's a challenge, and I don't really have an answer. But I think, I have spoken to the curator of contemporary art at the gallery about this, and she says she doesn't feel anxious about the arrival of the Zeitz Museum in September because she feels there'll be fruitful interactions between them. But I think it's inevitably going to be I would have thought, a pretty major worry for that gallery, and they need to figure out some really meaningful niche that they now occupy. When there is just down the road and in a sort of well-used part of town, a very much more fashionable part of town, there's going to be this fantastically well-funded, dedicated Museum of Contemporary Art. And what I just sort of hint at in my conclusion is that what the existing gallery might think of doing is collaborating far more with the social history collections and thinking of itself in terms of what you might call a collection of manufactured objects, a collection of visual artifacts. Try to make the art bit of it one section of a larger archive of things that people have made that are designed to be looked at. Because one of the things that, and this gets to the other part of my subtitle about art and national identity, running throughout the history of the gallery has been discussions about what belongs in that gallery. And the question of, well, if it's a vase, does it belong? If it's a plate, does it belong? No, it doesn't. Why not? Well, because that has a function, and fine art shouldn't have a function. So that sort of debate, which again we think is very, very recent, has been going on for a very long time. I mean, there was a very sort of thoughtful, interesting, dynamic woman at the beginning of the 20th century, Lady Phillips, married to one of the big landlords, who was a big part of this gallery, and she was a big part of the Johannesburg Art Gallery too. She was arguing for it to be a museum of arts and crafts on the model of the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, which had only recently opened. And that was a forward-thinking idea, and it was immediately dismissed. No, stupid idea. We're going to stick with the stuff that really counts, and that is painting and sculpture and certain kinds of prints and drawings that you don't use for any purpose, you just look at them. The fine art model. and, you know, now, of course, that's been bitten away at, and practicing artists no longer recognize those narrow parameters of fine art. But there's still the sense that something's got to be art before it gets into that particular collection. And I would favor thinking of it as a collection of made visually interesting artifacts, and then within that large project say, well, what's art about this particular thing? Why do we not say that that's art?
Yeah, and perhaps again, you know, as it has in its title, National Gallery representing in some way the nation, interrogating the question of the nation, which is a complicated question, obviously. As you point out in your book, as you just said, these debates have been going on for a long time, and one of the debates was about, I suppose, older art, Western art, old masters. One thing that surprised me was when donations of, for example, the Bailey collection, which you've curated on an exhibition, and there was some discussion around the Michaelis collection, which until recently was in the townhouse. Of course, the townhouse is closed at the moment, but the Dutch 17th century kind of old masters. What surprised me was that the general feeling amongst the public, the gallery going public, and the people, you know, who were on committees and so on, was not very favourable to this. There was a real desire for this museum to be collecting contemporary contemporary production, whether it was from Europe or from South Africa, and this kind of influx of old masters was almost seen as an embarrassment, which is quite strange to me. But perhaps, in terms of what you've been saying, maybe it should be a more modest collection, I suppose, in terms of its ambitions.
It struck me that it's always been a little bit unsure about whether it's an appropriate custodian of art from the distant past. And there were numerous examples of people reacting in the gallery, reacting rather ambivalently to promises of art that sort of predated 1850. And that's the kind of where I took as my cutoff point for old master, if it's older than that. And in the early days, often, if people were offering to give work, they'd say, we would like it to be modern work, the word that they use, we'd like it to be contemporary work. So they were seeing themselves as essentially focused with it, insofar as they were buying things, on the modern. And I saw that too in the discourse around Australian museums, and you see it too also in the early American museums. In the late 19th century, before the big American collectors got into the collecting of old masters, usually advised by European dealers, they were tending to buy contemporary art, as recent as possible. And there's some sort of strange link between the idea that we are a young nation without any roots and without any connection to the great tradition, and this sense that therefore it's contemporary art that's appropriate for us. And you see this at government level too, so that there's no appreciation of the huge Robinson collection of old master art that comes to the gallery in the 1950s, could have been bought by the government on behalf of the gallery, but they didn't want to pay the money for it, and so it was all taken away and sold off. And it was a fantastic collection of old master art. And the feeling was, well, and it wasn't quite articulated by this, but it doesn't belong. So there's that sort of...
And it seems that, you know, it would be fine if that was a decision. We don't want, you know, the Robinson old masters, but we're going to use that kind of those resources to buy, you know, in local art, historical art, whatever. But there does seem to be this this history that you portray, where a kind of a problem where there's a lack of will to have a very fixed idea about what the collection's going to actually hold and what its speciality is going to be. I mean, I was also very interested to note in the book that until Marilyn Martin's directorship, the acquisition policy of the gallery was not made public.
No,
and
or indeed not articulated at all.
Or
well, actually,
articulated
it was in
all,
John
yeah.
Harris's time.
And I mean, that's incredible to me in a way. And that's another question that I want to bring to bear. It strikes me that, you know, for much of this gallery's history, it's been an elitist institution where certain people, you know, who are in positions of social prestige or whatever it may be in society, are on the board of directors of the governing body, are influential. And it strikes me that ordinary people have not really had a voice in this gallery for a very long time. So we're having a discussion at the moment, I think, about, you know, popularizing museums and cultural spaces and making, you know, can we make this a people's gallery? There's no question, if one reads your book, or certainly from my reading of your book, that an elite has been very involved in purchasing the acquisitions, curators and acquisitions committees who have expertise, and that expertise often comes from a kind of academic background. You mentioned how important Neville Dubois was, the professor at Michaelis, how important Lippi Lipschitz was, the well-known South African sculptor, and they had a really strong impact on the kinds of things that were purchased, and obviously, as I said before, the directors as well. So my question is, where do the people come into this? Where do ordinary people come into directing the future, and in terms of what you've been writing, where did they come into the past of the gallery, I suppose? Has it always been an elitist structure?
Well, I don't know how much of an elitist structure. I'm not sure how elitist those trustees boards were. I mean, Neville Dubois wasn't a wealthy man who was out of touch with people.
I suppose intellectually elitist in a way.
Well, yeah, I don't know that you can avoid that. I think museums are, they're an acquired taste. not everybody is interested in going to them. It requires a tremendous amount of knowledge to be a specialist in one of the departments of the museum. I don't think we should forget that it's quite a difficult and demanding intellectual job to work in a museum. And while I'm advocating in my conclusion a more accessible kind of museum for the future by this sort of merger of what is recognised as art with what might be thought of to be the social history collections. I don't think that you're going to be able to get the person on the street to curate exhibitions just because functional objects that he or she uses on a daily basis are going to be part of them. Because it remains a very difficult business to work out how to make meaningful and establish relationships between objects and to then make them, and to know enough to make, to bring them to life, to bring their past to life. So, you know, the kind of the populist ideal is, I think it falls down at that point. That
Well, I mean, I think the history of the National Gallery, as you portray it, you know, with a few moments of diversions, has been one of people in academic power or other kinds of social power controlling. We can disagree about that. And my last question is an important one, I think, and that is around decolonization. And your history, certainly as far as I can read it, shows a strong history of a colonial imperative behind certainly the establishment of the museum. It was extremely colonial. It was expressly colonial in its ideology, collecting art from particularly England at first. And there were even protests in 1930 when the building of you now know as the National Gallery opened, where artists complained about the fact that there were no South African artists, there were only artists from England on display. We have a more pressing issue around decolonization, and it's one that I know that the curators at the National Gallery are addressing as we speak. From the history and the deep research that you've done for this book, what insights do you have around the issue of decolonization and decolonization of the institution and the collection itself? Is it possible? Is this a hopelessly colonially aligned institution? Is there some way that the institution can be shifted? And also the collections, in terms of the history of the collections and the donors and the intentions, which you speak about, sometimes very problematic intentions to unify white people in South Africa, for example, in the case of the Michaelis bequest and the Bailey bequest, which spoke to a kind of fantasy of patrician European aristocracy. Is there a way that this collection and this museum can be decolonized, or is it hopelessly enmeshed in a kind of colonial past?
Well, this concept of decolonization, I suppose it, colonization is, indicates here the domination of one culture by another that's foreign to it.
I suppose so the assumption of a superiority of a particular culture, a white European culture,
right.
I suppose.
I mean, I would come back to the point that I made about my interest in the concept of art, where it begins and ends here, because an art gallery of its very nature is a European construct, and I think that they are weird institutions and weird in all sorts of ways and could do with quite a radical shake-up, wherever they are, quite apart from whether they contain a lot of work by some other culture. And what I was saying at the very outset, too, is that all these big major galleries have made it their business to collect the art of other cultures, but haven't felt dominated by it. So, you know, you might find yourself in Paris looking at rooms and rooms of Italian art, but not feeling, therefore, that you've been colonized. So we've got an interesting issue going on in South Africa, where there isn't a recognition of just how globally interconnected everything is, and how if you're going to be interested in a canonical tradition, whether it be in literature or art or music, you're probably going to be spending quite a lot of time listening to people or looking at people who don't come from your own country. Mm-hmm. It's music, it's going to be Germany or Italy. You could decide that on patriotic grounds you're not going to have anything to do with that. or you could decide not to feel too threatened by it. Think, well, you know, there was an awful lot of that in my country's past, and we're doing things differently now. And, you know, I think this gallery, it could frankly acknowledge its past and how heavily enmeshed it was with a country like Britain. But that was the past. And it could, you know, as I suggest in the conclusion, it could actually frame exhibitions around the idea of looking at how these collections came about, why it was that there's so much British art there.
One of the very refreshing things that you do in a kind of historical survey is you look to the future and you make suggestions, practical suggestions about what you think might be a way forward. And one of the things that you mention is a way of making the collection more accessible is you know, digitization, making it accessible on the web, for example. And again, I wasn't aware of the incredible depth of the National Gallery's collections, which you point out. I mean, something like, you just mentioned that there were at one point 290 Ashanti bronze figurines acquired in the 1950s, which I might be wrong, but I certainly don't remember seeing many of those on exhibitions recently at the National Gallery. And the fact that the National Gallery's collections haven't been adequately catalogued and photographed and documented, so perhaps that's one way forward is to, you know, in terms of looking backwards, is actually assessing what the national collection actually contains. And I know that there is a impetus in Iziko to digitize and to look to this. So perhaps that's a very refreshing possibility.
Yeah, I mean, for example, there's a fabulous collection of works on paper, of prints and drawings, including a whole range of work from South Africa and from overseas, contemporary and of the distant past. It's very rarely seen because in the 1960s, the dedicated watercolour room, as it was called, was abandoned because of worries that the light was affecting the work. And so virtually nobody sees this stuff now. And it's a great resource. They've got a lot of it because throughout their history, they haven't been able to afford paintings and sculptures, which have been always more expensive than works on paper. So they've tended to buy work on paper where they could, and it's a fabulous collection as a result, but virtually nobody knows about it. So that's the sort of thing that digitization could really make possible, and it's very incomplete at the moment, but it requires funding, and there's never enough funding.
Indeed, the history of the National Gallery is the history of lack of funding. And I'm going to open it to questions, if there are any questions from the floor. Is there a roving mic? Okay. Over there.
Thank you for your presence. It's good to read. I just want to know, has there been an attempt from the National Gallery from an education point to direct education exhibitions that are done in the African languages? Because I think that could be another sort of way to interpret the art or the artifacts that are there.
Yes.
So, in your time that you've been there, has there been an attempt to sort of intellectualize some of the objects, the artifacts, through the use of mother tongue languages? And I'm not just meaning specifically for the country, because I think when you talk about art, we're talking about, yes, that's important in South Africa, which is the National Gallery, but I think our sort of nationality does tie into other sort of regions.
Yeah.
And, so maybe we could...
If I may, I just want to clarify, Anna's not representing the National Gallery of Iziko.
No, I can ask her that way. I'm just talking...
No, I'm just saying, she'll answer the question. I just want to make it clear.
Have you dealt with that in your practice? If I can maybe just ask the question to you, in that, has there been an attempt in, while you've been at the gallery to use languages, African languages in particular,
to increase access
yes. From an educational point of view, and maybe just can give us one or two examples.
Well, I mean, look, it's a good question. There was an example. It's something that Marilyn Martin was very strong on when she came in 1990. She wanted to try to increase access and make the place more user-friendly to a wider population, she was very keen that labelling should be done in three languages. And it hadn't been until that time. It's not been maintained all that well, but that was in the 1990s. There was a time when that was really at the forefront of people's minds. There was an exhibition, Ezequantu, for example, a study of beadwork from the Eastern Cape, that made sure that, recognising the nature of the exhibition, that it was available in different languages for people to read. So yeah, but not the catalogue. Yeah, it's a good point. And actually, if you go back earlier into history, talking about the different kind of national groupings, in the 1930s, Afrikaans speakers on the Board of Trustees were very unhappy because the labels were only printed in English at that time, and they wanted to see them bilingually. And again, that was frustrating because they very often weren't.
No, but it is an important point about language. I mean, yeah. That's your first point of access. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that point.
I'm looking forward to reading your book. I wonder if you could just elaborate a little bit more about the time that the National Gallery did have a lot of money in the 1960s. Because obviously this was a time of huge political repression,
yes.
The time of Foster, Verwoerd,
yes.
All those sorts of things. So how does one think about, I suppose, politics, nation, art, in a time of the repressive apartheid regime plowing
yes,
into the National Gallery, and how one thinks about that?
From reading the archives, you wouldn't know that there had been any such problems. they flourished. They opened a restoration department. They opened. This was the time when they opened an education department for the first time, and they were keen to try to reach groups that they hadn't reached before. But they bought more than they'd ever done before, and they were buying South African art. And as I said, they were starting to buy some work by black practitioners as well, both contemporary and historical. But I haven't found a great deal of debate in the minutes of the board meetings about sort of the horrors that were going on outside the walls of the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense was that Matthijs Bockhorst, who was ready to retire when they dragged him in to be the director at that time, because they wanted Anton Hendricks from Johannesburg, and he wouldn't take the job because he felt that it just wasn't properly supported at the gallery. So they got Bockhorst to serve out of their last few years, and I think he was a supreme diplomat because he managed to just keep in with this government while being apparently a fairly enlightened man himself, but managing to keep on the right side of the government, another interesting case was his successor but one, who was Raymond van Niekerk, who had terrible trouble with government interference.
Mm.
And there were typically, it was suspected, government informers on the board of the trustees. The government could always appoint four of the trustees on the board. One of the trustees at that time had a brother who was in the cabinet, and the others felt very strongly that the messages were taken back about the kind of decisions.
Mm.
And kind of, so it was a nasty.
I mean, this is a fascinating thing you do in the book, because you talk about the kind of political what was happening in the country more broadly, and then it does seem like, you know, this was this little isolated bubble just doing its own thing. But as you point out, there were often these fights with the board, and
yeah.
I mean, people being accused of being traitors and things like that, and having ANC alliances, you know, in at the time of apartheid, which I found very interesting as well. I think we have time for a couple more questions.
I'm just curious, you have some really interesting phrases. You mentioned that museums are only acquired taste, and there's a certain specialization of knowledge that it takes to lead a certain department. And you mentioned that there is a canonical tradition involved in museum management. So then what happens when we have this canonical tradition when it comes to forms of art that we have not been canonized and don't know how to understand, like things like digital art and
yes.
you know, certain new mediums? What does that happen when certain kinds of works are in the public consciousness and they are actual social hieroglyphics? How are they then incorporated into a canonical tradition?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a very interesting question, not only for the art museum, but for the academic world of art history, too. How do you decide when to bring in new people and new names? How do you decide who deserves to come in? Within the art museum, it's the grave responsibility of the acquisitions board to decide whether a work is worth investing a lot of money in, and sometimes if it's somebody who hasn't really had an established career as yet, you're taking a big risk. One of the things that the gallery typically did in the early days was only buy people once they had become well established as names, and that changed in 1990 when they started to actively promote to buy people who were really just setting out on their careers, people recently graduated. So that's exactly a case of deciding to not worry too much about the canon. And the other thing I would say about that is that the whole idea of a canon has got so challenged now that there's no consensus really on who belongs and whether it matters anymore. I mean, there's so much out there, and there are so many competing voices who are saying. And there's also so much scepticism about the idea of experts, so that people like Andrew and myself, who are teaching art history, are not necessarily thought to know any better than anybody else, and maybe for good reason.
And possibly for good reason, I was going to say, yes. If I could just, it's not something in the book, but I just wanted to mention something that I happen to know from personal knowledge in Ezeko is, one of the things that, you know, the newly appointed curators have been very interested in the point that you're making about how do we incorporate these things. And one of the, for me, very exciting things is that, for example, performances have been sponsored to take place at various events in Ezeko. And that's because of complications with Ezeko funding. Those have been done by the Friends of the Gallery, which is also something that you mentioned, the importance of the Friends of the Gallery. And so I think there is an attempt to address it, but if I may, and I think one of the things that you point out as well is that institutions by their very nature are slow aren't necessarily adapted to these kind of changes, which is a problem, I think, maybe underlying the point that you
Somebody says that culture is the corpse of the past, you know, it's always behind the times, so it's the job of people in academia and in museums to always trying to be catching up, you know, but it's, yeah.
Do we have another question? One more question, I think.
Anna, what motivated the choice of your title? What motivated the choice of your title, artist?
Oh, this.
Yes.
It's a work that's recently been bought by the gallery. A fabulous work, and one that the Friends of the Gallery paid half of the purchase price towards, and I wanted to honour the Friends who've been an enormously important part of the gallery. That was another thing that started in the 1960s, this group of people who fundraise and support the gallery and buy works on its behalf, and this is one of the latest ones that they have contributed hugely towards. And I mean, they're enormously important for a gallery that's always short of funds. And it's, I mean, Sabandi's work is so marvellous and so triumphant, this seemed, and I thought it might seem an optimistic image for a gallery that I hope has a really good future. I mean, it's such an interesting place, it has such a marvellous collection, and it deserves to be better known and more loved.
I think one of the things that you illustrate in your book is that the people who have worked there, the people who have invested their time, argued, fought, sometimes really bitterly fought around this institution, really loved what it was, and right or wrong, good or bad, they believed in it. And I think that's true of the people who are there now. It is our National Gallery. It does have that name. As I pointed out in my opening remarks, it clearly has a kind of emotional response with people. And it is our gallery. We must take ownership of it. Every single person in the country, every person here, it's our gallery. And this book, you know, presents a long view in comparison to what generally people know about the National Gallery. It's a lot of it is about gossip and hearsay and things like that. And this is a very seriously researched overview of the history of the gallery, which is absolutely thrilling in terms of the ups and downs, the arguments, the debates, the changes, the shifts in the policy. And as you pointed out, the repetition of the same issues happening over and over again. So I think it's essential reading if you are interested in art in South Africa. And I can assure you it's a really good read. So thank you very much, Anna. If there are more questions or anyone wants to have a discussion, I think Anna will be here. She'll also be here to sign copies of the book if anyone wishes to purchase them. And thank you very much for your attention. And thank you, Anna, for talking about the book and for writing it.
I'd just like to say thanks to Limbs and Wine Sponsors, thanks to Anna and Andrew for coming out to chat to us tonight, and also just let you know what's coming up for the rest, for next week. On Tuesday we have Chwaita Ngamlana here, and she's a really exciting new voice in South African literature, and her novel If I Stay Right Here is really great. I think you should come. And then on Wednesday we have Jonathan Johnson here for his latest As By Fire, and he'll be in conversation with Jacques Rousseau. And then on Thursday we have something that I've forgotten.